subsist.
The culture, then I think that's not true.
Yeah.
Dated in 1880, where the missionaries located a town site for the people of Heidelberg, and that when they adopted his recommendations, and the fields outlined ready for Sewell managed to take charge of what can be made in a few years an entirely self-supporting plantation. Well, that was an economic system,
yeah.
But that's where Heidelberg came from,
yeah.
In 1880. I was going to leave these for some of the other stuff, and this is why we don't have Indians.
Okay.
Sheldon Jackson in 1895,
and
this was reported to Congress by the Secretary of Interior at the first session in 1896. And this is the law I think I talked about one time before that talked about how natives could get citizenship.
Yeah.
And then the document that was signed by my grandfather.
Your grandfather, yeah.
And the rest of them.
Yeah. So yeah, actually, you gave me that.
Yeah.
Maybe that day would.
Maybe we should be seated again. I knew this would happen if we took a coffee break, but there you are. Maybe we can start again. As you know, we intend tomorrow, all going well, to discuss harvesting rights and land management, and we intended on the third day, that is on Friday, to talk about the initiatives Native people have been taking to establish their own subsistence regimes. And we had referred to the Whaling Commission, the Walrus Commission, the Porcupine Caribou Commission, and so on. We may just turn now, I think it follows from the discussion we were having, to one of those initiatives in Western Alaska. Tony Vasca and Harold Spark can tell us about that, and they do wish to respond to what has been said by Gary and Tom and Don. So maybe, Tony, if you would lead off.
Thank you very much. I suppose by way of introduction, I should say that one of the reactions that we have in rural Alaska, and I think basically I can identify it as reactions, is in posturing before regulatory agencies that do have an effect on our lives, especially our subsistence lives, then we have to adopt strategies at different levels to respond to different actions by those regulatory agencies for the regulation or management of the different species that we deal with. The strategies that we adopt for something specific, the Hooper Bay Agreement dealing with migratory birds, is something that was done specifically to deal with a resource that we utilize on an annual basis. And I think that most people would identify specifically those individual species of birds that we use for food and identify them in a variety of ways, whether they're endangered, threatened, or overutilized, underutilized. It only becomes a problem when the bird species drops drastically. And our experience has been that in the past, most of that blame points to us. And I think we're probably, I don't want to say we're getting used to it, but we come to expect that when there's a population crisis in any of the species, the first reaction by the regulatory agencies or by non-native peoples is to point to us as the users of those resources and blame us for the reduction or the fall in the population of those species. And we can point to many examples, and I think the Northwest caribou herd is also a prime example of that that we can point to. We use the same kind of strategies in our approach with other areas of competition, if you want to use that word. I don't like to use that word, but basically we have a lot of fights with allocation of resources, and if you look at our battles at the present time with the Japanese trawl fisheries in the high seas, it extends to having to deal with international agencies, because those actions and activities bear directly on the harvest levels of the salmon species that we use in the case of fish, and in the case of birds, where the birds are harvested not only in Alaska, but perhaps Canada, Russia, Mexico. The specifics for developing strategies in dealing with those particular species is interesting only in, well, not only in effect, but it's interesting in one aspect, and that aspect is that we've come to realize that to make changes, we need to understand specifically what those regulatory agencies are and how to work them. I think our response is that for too long, the decision, for instance, for the United States government to go into treaty with the countries of Canada, Mexico, Russia, Japan, happened not at home among people who utilize those species directly, but among governments who in many cases are responding to those very agencies and agents that Don Mitchell was talking about. People who happen to come into an area and report consequences of regulatory actions at a much higher level. And for a long time we've been reacting to those decisions and trying to find some access to the decision makers, or in fact ideally become decision makers ourselves. And obviously it's a two-sided coin from our perspective in the fact that if we are willing to make those decisions, we're also willing to accept the responsibility for the complete management and protection of those species. I think before I get into the details too far, Harold should talk about that, because he's been involved with all of the villages and the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Department of Fish and Game, California Waterfowl Association, Department of Interior, the Canadian Wildlife Federation, Ducks Unlimited, Sebastiani Vineyards. it's amazing who you talk to when you get into that arena, because it's those people who are particularly interested in the propagation of those species or the maintenance of the populations. So I will leave it at that and simply outline that we have had to find out who in fact has specific interests in not only those species, but the environment. I mean, Ducks Unlimited, for instance, has this huge waterfowl habitat program to make sure that the rice fields in California continue to stay in existence. So you're dealing with agricultural machines in California, and some of those are a bit much to put up with, but they're part of the strategy that we've had to develop to deal with protecting the birds after they leave the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and go off to wherever they do every year and come back. Harold?
Harold Spark. And Harold, since you will be leaving tonight and not returning, feel free to move beyond the Hooper Bay Agreement and to tackle the issues raised by this troika of Lawner, Holthouse, and Mitchell.
Well, you know, frankly, I'm very thankful for the conversations I've listened to. I live in a goldfish bowl in Bethel, and I don't very often get out. That's on personal choice. But it is refreshing to come out and hear different opinions. One of the things that we had to do, for those who remember children's fairy tales, is when in August of this year, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, August of last year, showed up and said, the sky is falling, and the native people of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are responsible for it, solely responsible for the loss of all these geese. Many of us who lived through the early 50s remember that hysteria of who lost China. And it looked like we were going to the same hysteria now, but where the geese disappeared to? Well, it became rather confusing to many of the elders who were sitting in attendance of this meeting, passively listening to the Fish and Wildlife Service, blaming them for this whole history of mismanagement and biological changes, both man-made and natural, that were occurring in the habitat of the geese in question. So after the Fish and Wildlife Service got through all of its moaning and groaning, the villagers excused them. And the first thing that came out of the several of the elders' mouths was, wait a minute, they're talking about these animals that we eat. Now, when we were young, when these animals were strong in numbers, the little birds that fly around like clouds were very strong too. Nobody eats them. How come they are very few in number too? They go to the very same places that these big birds go to. And maybe what these guys are saying is that they're looking for somebody to blame all this problem on. So our concern is, number one, we got to make sure that we're not stuck with the onus of being responsible for this whole thing. But number two, we have to watch out for our children. And it was a deliberate decision by the elders in that meeting that they wanted migratory waterfowl at the turn of the century, and that they were going to do whatever was necessary in order to ensure that their children and their grandchildren were going to have future access. They then started listing where their concerns were. And we're sort of out of sync here with the rest of the conversation that's been going on today, so I'll try and link it back to the general discussions on subsistence. Number one is the allocation issue. But the villagers were very concerned. They did not want to get tied into a bag, into a flower of into flour, into a sack that said we are only going to discuss who can kill the birds. What we have to discuss is not only who can take the birds, but we also have to discuss the subsistence way of life, what resources are important to us as substitutes for birds if we are going to voluntarily retard our take of these birds, what habitat we have to concern ourselves with for not only the birds, but these alternate resources, and then fourth, how do we find out who the players are in the lower 48, in Canada, in Mexico, and in the Soviet Union, all these interest groups? So there was a decision reached, what Tony refers to as a strategy, that we had to make a comprehensive agreement. We couldn't just get linked into what the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service wanted of no native take of migratory waterfowl in the springtime. What happened was a series of meetings, and the meetings took place, and during the meetings, for the first time, there was an interchange between the California takers and the Alaskan takers of these very same waterfowl. Articles started appearing in the national press blaming the native peoples of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. They were responsible. Well, the first thing the villagers asked of the Californians was lower the guns. You're not going to get anywhere with us if you're asking for voluntary compliance. The villagers reported that they had read the Congressional Committee reports that it would take at least $2.3 to $3 million for enforcement, any adequate level of enforcement in the Yukon Delta, if you had to involuntarily prevent village hunters from taking birds they need to feed their families. And the villagers were very comfortable with the idea that the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service didn't have the money and didn't have the wherewithal to go raise the money either and come out and harass them. They wanted to sit down and look at the long-term good for both the native community and the birds. And if it also benefited the Californians, then that would probably be all right, too. The situation then developed into a series of agreements. In Chivac in November, with California present, the villagers became very aware for the first time that the Fish and Wildlife Service was pocketing the information. And it was using it for political ammunition to enrage the Californians against the Alaskan natives. There was voluntary agreements by the villages beginning in 77 on select bird species. Many of you know that the villages of the Delta gave the Fish and Wildlife Service 13 million acres of land in the form of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. They did insist, however, on habitat conservation. They did insist on subsistence access to the resources, a privilege or a priority in the take of whatever resources existed. The agreement in Chivac dealt with the entire flyway. We linked take in the Yukon Delta to conversion of wetlands in the Central Valley of California that began in the 1930s into rice production, to the take by gringos out of Los Angeles going down into Mexico and hunting without any enforcement whatsoever. And there was a, with the tightening of the bird take, geese take in California, there was this healthy exodus of people into Mexico where there's no enforcement whatsoever. So the villagers said, this has to be international. We don't want to be blindsided sometime in the future. And it has to be comprehensive. In Chivac, agreements were reached across the board. And it was on the environment. Many of you are familiar now with the industrialization of the continental shelf and the Arctic basin. Both our Canadian neighbors and the Alaskans know what's happening in the Canadian and Alaskan Beaufort, will be happening in the Chukchi and in the Bering Sea. There's just going to be increased activity there. And as I said earlier, we made the effort of including the marine areas as part of the upland conservation units. We lost on that area. It's ironic that all of the lands that are going to be utilized by birds for nesting, these very threatened or critically endangered birds, would all be impacted by an oil spill during a 3 to 4 inch high tide, much less a 20 or 30 year storm event. If there was an oil spill, it would inundate the tundra. You could kiss off the birds completely. But the federal government, one agency of the Department of the Interior was saying, we care about the birds. Another agency, the Department of the Interior, the Minerals Management Service, was saying, we don't care about the birds. We don't care about anything other than finding oil. And so we had cross purposes in trying to get the Department of the Interior to sit down with us and be consistent. Well, the Minerals Management Service was never consistent, so we just had to deal then with the Fish and Wildlife Service. They agreed that there was no conservation problems or differences with our villages, and that they, the good guys that they were, they would start looking after the Minerals Management Service and the oilies and making sure that they would pay attention to detail. So we started in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and we started identifying all the habitat there that was essential for the birds. We also explained to them about that, in case you didn't notice it, guys, fox eat bird eggs, and fox eat chickens, and minks eat the same thing. And by the way, you know, flooding does the same thing. It just kills the nest. And before you guys start sending your troops all over the country blaming the Alaskan natives anymore for the decline in birds, by the way, why don't you tell your biologists to start recording what the predator take is and what the natural hazards are out there? Maybe that has a significant impact on these bird populations while they're in Alaska. The second area we concerned ourselves with was Eisenbeck Lagoon, which is the largest eelgrass beds in the world. Black brant, one species, has a 52-hour flight from Eisenbeck Lagoon to Mexico. They fatten up for 6 weeks in Eisenbeck Lagoon. Well, it just so happens that our new friends, the oilies, use Cold Bay for their helicopters to service the oil rigs in St. George. So we got assurances from the Fish and Wildlife Service in Chivac in November of 83 that they would ensure that the helicopters would not disturb the birds when they were in Eisenbeck Lagoon. We then moved on to California, and we were able to assist, as a matter of fact, we were used as propaganda by the California Department of Fish and Game to get a $80 million bond issue through to buy wetlands back in the Central Valley of California. Then we got on to Mexico. And with Mexico, it was, what do we do about all these gringos going down there and blowing away the birds that their fellow Californians are freely giving up? And that's a sticky one. And that involves a international protocol between the United States and Mexico. But it has influences also in the U.S.-Canadian treaty and the U.S.-Soviet and Japanese treaty. We finally got a commitment from the federal government and the national government of Mexico that they would suddenly pay attention to the number of people going down there to harvest the waterfowl, and that they would start recording the take and start paying attention to habitat there also. The second phase of the agreement was allocation. Who gets what of what's left? We have maintained that the federal government has a responsibility to the Alaskan Native people to, if there are birds that can be taken, that subsistence has to be taken care of first. And this is, again, with threatened habitat. The federal government has refused, ever since 1978, to publish regulations that would give, legalize the subsistence take of waterfowl, or a preference for people who are subsistence takers above recreational takers. We're living in that quandary. What we did, we said, listen, California, our interest is working with you, not with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service right now. How do we try and solve these the bird problem? Our villages voluntarily agreed to lay down their guns and to stop taking eggs in exchange for California reducing their take by 50%. So we went around the federal government in order to get this a taker-to-taker agreement, and then California supported our habitat concerns. Lo and behold, our villages complied, California's complied. Every place where we depended on the federal government to comply, however, has fallen to hell. They have not come across. It's been a woeful situation dealing with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, and that is something that our villages predicted, because they said they did not have an interest like we had an interest and the Californians had an interest in the well-being of these birds. They were protecting themselves from someone in Congress convening the hearing of where the birds went, because they're the ones who'd be holding the bag. The situation was important for, I believe, for this, for the review of this group, because it dealt with, in addition to the allocation issue, competition from another resource taker. There is no protections from California taking all the birds. They've done a hell of a good job on it ever since the 30s. They've taken them in two forms. They've taken them as food, and then they've denied them the wetlands that the birds use for wintering. That's another form of take. They're dead animals. Our villages were impressed when they went to California. What they saw were the number of birds in one lake that were spread over 30 to 50 square miles in the delta in the wintertime. If someone happened to drop a little pollution off of their agricultural runoff into those lakes, you could just count the mortalities. Pestilence between the birds was really significant. The people were very impressed with the number of blisters and scars on the birds in the wintering grounds, and that was in large parts of the population. So it was an effort to try and get California to own up to its responsibility. And at least where we are right now, it was because it was taker to taker, we felt that we got a pretty good response. This summer, our villages followed the agreement. You can read about it on page 53 of Steve Langdon's report, beginning on 53. I'm sorry, Steve, I haven't read it yet, but it's there. I hope it's you know, everything's in there that's helpful for everyone. Going back to what Don was talking about earlier, and that is this issue of what you do with the resource when somebody else wants it. I think this is a good example of where the federal government has failed to protect the interest of the people who live on subsistence and who require these birds. Woody was talking earlier from his experience in Shagaluk about the necessity for this kind of food, a seasonal necessity in the springtime. And the way the Migratory Bird Treaty Act reads with Canada is March 10th is a closure, September 1st is the opening. So any native take other than certain forms of seabirds and cliff-dwelling birds is illegal. The villages have done it anyhow, they have to. What Don was pointing out, the fact that the government either is callow, doesn't pay attention, or is racist at best, I think is very evident in the situation of birds. The feelings that rose up by the competition was to blame the natives. We were without any political strength to change that situation. The only strength we had was the fact that we are located in the far distant corner of the earth, the fact that our villagers honeycombed the area, an area of 33,000 miles, and the fact that it's almost impossible for the federal government to get in there if the villages aren't willing to cooperate and do something to involuntarily change their habits. That is the only reason the federal government had to deal with us. We could have expected that if they could have done it any other way, that in order to appease California, particularly under our current federal administration, they would have been in there and been doing it to our villages. So when Tony talks about strategy, that's what we had to work with. The limited resources available to us, the fact that we had very few allies, the only thing we had was really the village people. We could count on them. And once an agreement was struck where they saw some level of equity, the equity being a similar cutback and take by California compared to the village cutback, the villages agreed with it and they followed it. And again, the guiding principle is birds at the turn of the century. That's what they wanted, our villages wanted. I'd like to get on to a second issue, and that is the issue of habitat. And Don mentioned it briefly, and that is this competition. The competition is going to become even more serious in the future. There's only so much land space and so much ocean space. As I mentioned earlier, it's been our deliberate political effort to reduce the new users and to limit their uses of the resources that the village people depend on. We know of no other way of trying to protect a village economy. We are without the political strength if we have to go head to head, like in the courts or in the Congress, with users who talk in billions of dollars, like the oil companies. We must try and protect the habitat so that when the wildlife fluctuations occur, they have room to recover. If we give it up to the oilies, we've lost it because they won't give it back to us, or else they'll give it back to us damaged. The competition that our villages fear, again using the birds as the example, is that they won't have the resources in the future that's going to be adequate for subsistence, the ones that they're harvesting right now. So they are trying to set aside all of the resources that they use historically. Neither the federal government or the state government understand that. The new industrial users couldn't care less. There's no penalties for them if they damage those resources, mainly because government doesn't know and doesn't care. So it has been a 10-year or a decade-long effort. Once the villages made the decision that they had to protect their future, both their subsistence economy and then what surpluses exist that they convert into cash from change. And they go kicking and screaming every time someone proposes change. They have to have their teeth pulled out without Novocaine using pliers, and that's the only way they make their point, and they finally get some level of concession. Many of the elders are not sanguine about the future. They maintain that when the flooding occurred, when the natural disasters occurred, the birds moved to another place or there was another fish stock to take to. They point at the turn of the century when there were 15,000 Aboriginal people living in the area of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. At that time, you had no Japanese high seas salmon fishery, which at times had as many as 400 boats, each one of them launching 12 miles of net a day for 3 months every year. There was no effort by the trawl fisheries to kill off the marine mammals in the ocean. There was not a significant loss of habitat in California that's needed by the birds. The federal government was not leasing the North Aleutian Shelf, the St. George Basin, the Navarin Basin, all the havens for reproduction during the migratory year of the marine mammals and marine birds that the villages depend upon. And there was no anchorage at that time. There weren't all these super cubs coming out into the area where Woody lived, into the tree line, taking all the ungulates walking the land. And there weren't a large number of people jumping other people's trap lines. All of those things exist now. What the villages have said is that we have more people than we have animals right now, and we have to, the only way we're ever going to get by in the future is to protect our habitat. And that has been a dedication that they have moved to. And again, it'll be a repetitious then, they have refused to get caught in an allocation bind. They will not sit down at any meeting and talk just who gets the birds or who gets the moose or who gets the mink. They have linked the habitat and the government's handling of the habitat to every resource decision that they're making.
How many villages involved in this?
There's 56.
The whole
of the Delta. They sit down in unison. And one of the things that Gary was talking about there aren't any 19 to 17 votes still. It's by consensus. And there won't be a decision for many months. And Bristol Bay is the same way. Many of the villages in Norton Sound that I've dealt with are the same way. It has to be by consensus and only after a full airing of all the issues. But anyhow, that's what they see as their future, and people like me, Don calls himself a mechanic, I guess I'm an engineer then, but the villages give us direction. And one thing I'd like to say also that has been very important is that in recent years, it used to be that there was so much confusion and misunderstanding in the villages, they would take somebody like me and say, go out and do the best job you can. There's been a conversion within the last 5 years that no longer do we trust our aides. This is serious stuff. Mainly, there is no more left to give away. Anything that we trade now comes off of our dinner table, and we have to be involved in it. So, like the people up in the borough and up in the sound, they have, the elders, even though they have limited English, have been seating themselves at the table now in all discussions. And people like myself applaud that because it's pretty hard sitting there and deciding what you want to give up if you've been told to protect something. And it's been very valuable to us, again, people like myself, that not only are the villages giving direction, but now they're sitting there and actually carrying out the agreements and deciding what values they want to protect, when they want to protect them, and how they want to protect them. If there are to be trades, they're in control of what's to be given up.
Thanks, Harold. David, you had a question for Don?
First, Don, I must confess I hadn't counted on my book getting a review before it got published. And I guess I'd be the first to admit that I am naive, but somehow that the law school must have slipped up, and the bar too. But the question I do have goes to, I think, an important point that you made, and that is this historical analysis of how various regimes have protected access, but not protected against competition. And I'd like, I think a lot of that, a lot of the morning, which you had to miss, involved that same question. And I wondered if you could comment on the degree to which the provisions of ANILCA meet that problem.
Sure. Also, I have one other thing I wanted to say about Harold's comments about habitat, too, when I'm through with this. For openers, by the way, in terms of my crack about reviewing your book before it's actually hit the book cache, you know, I think one thing that's important to recognize about all of this is that what we're really talking with a lot of this stuff are figments of the non-native intellectual imagination. We are describing a lot of this stuff as if it's real, and it's not real at all. It is just stuff that us non-natives have thought up in our heads in terms of how we're all going to behave so that we don't end up slitting each other's throats. And to that extent, it really is sophistry and gibberish and illusion. And my only point is that it should be acknowledged as such, that that's exactly what it is, if in fact the benefits of that system that nobody created, including you and I, are to really be maximized on behalf of the Native community. And that's sort of what I was attempting to get at with respect to whether or not it's a word game. Yes, in my judgment, it is a word game. With respect to ANILCA, ANILCA in many respects is like the state subsistence laws we all know. And I think that ANILCA, for those of you that are not familiar with the basic concept, does at least begin to deal with the situation in that Congress and also the state legislature, for the first time, has as a state policy and a national policy said that in situations in which there is competition, that as a matter of state and federal policy, it is the obligation of the state and federal regulatory systems to protect the native community, in essence, from having that intrusion compromise their situation. And certainly, as far as a statement of policy, I think it's really, at least with my reading of the historical record, it is the first statement of policy by government that goes directly to the competition issue and settles it squarely in favor of folks in the villages. That having been said, you know, one of the wonderful things about the legal profession is that the answer can never be no. If somebody tells you no, you slink back to your office and think about it a bit. Come back on them, you know. You can always get back at least three quarters of the ground you've lost after a decision has been made. And unfortunately, that's exactly the way the reality of that statement of policy by government, I think, comes down, because that reality, that statement of policy has no reality except through the process through which it is implemented. And I think that the political tensions about the competition issue that I described earlier really still hold. And it is only even with I think some really pretty committed people now, at least particularly on the state side in the regulatory process, even with those kinds of folks around, it is only with the most, you know, begrudging sort of reluctance that the regulatory system is really committed to implementing that policy statement. I mean, you've really got to make the case. And if there's any way around it politically, you figure out, well, isn't there something we could do to just shave this thing, and maybe next year it'll all go away when the game board comes back. And I mean, you know, we've all been involved in countless efforts. And what have we been attempting to do? We've been attempting to salvage the most that we could in a particular situation of that policy statement, without getting involved in a political allocation hassle that even after my rave reviews for the Claims Act, we didn't have the political power or the economic power to win. And so to that extent, I think the policy itself is a significant step forward in the history of the way government has related to the subsistence economy of the Alaska Native folks. But in terms of its reality, time will tell. With respect to Harold's sort of statements about habitat, one thing I did want to say is that I devoted most of my remarks primarily to the allocation issue, because for the past 20 years or so, it has really been the allocation issues that have got the most heat and light and smoke and commotion and aggravation and emotion surrounding them. But I think that particularly since the enactment of ANILCA settled once and for all land patterns, I think obviously land use will come to play a more important role in this whole equation from here on out. And you know, one of the things about that I find amusing is that, you know, there was once another pretty decent subsistence economy on the plains of the lower 48. And that subsistence economy was dependent upon 5 or 6 or 10 or 20, however you want to count it, million buffalo rampaging around at will through 10 or 12 different states. Well, if you look at how many buffalo we got up there in Delta, Larry? A couple hundred head? If you look at the commotion that a couple hundred head of buffalo have done to the aspirations of the state of Alaska to develop its agricultural potential, assuming such a thing exists, you know, in one small area, you can imagine how inconvenient it would be to our, speaking as a non-native, economic system to have 5 or 10 million buffalo running through downtown Omaha, Nebraska whenever they felt like it. I mean, that kind of stuff just could not be allowed to go on in our economic system. And I would suggest that that has not had to be confronted in Alaska, because for so many years there was so much commotion over who owned what land and what and how that economic system could deal with it that it was all irrelevant. Now that that's settled, I would suggest that there's really only two points of view. As I understand, at least I don't want to speak for them or to oversimplify their position, but basically, as I understand most of my associates in the professional environmental community, they look at Alaska as part of the lower 48 economic system and say that in the aggregate, habitat has paid enough cost to maintain the United States as an economy, and therefore you don't need to go into Alaska. I think that if you look at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, their point of view would be to say, don't look at Alaska as part of the United States of America. Look at Alaska as if it were a separate economic nation. And with respect to it being a separate economic nation, it looks about like the lower 48 did probably back in about 1890, for lack of a better date to pick. And if that is the case, then I would suggest that what is going to have to be done with Alaskan habitat in the long run over time is exactly what's going to have to have been done with habitat in the lower 48. And what that does, assuming that those decisions will be made not because anybody cares about Alaska Natives, but they care about the way the world really works, that's a given. And what that's going to mean, of course, is that habitat necessary to support these resources is going to diminish, which means that the harvestable surplus of each of these resources is going to diminish, which also means that if the competition even remains constant rather than increases, the squeeze will increasingly be on. And that is, again, we're talking about not a 24-month trip down the road. I'm talking about between now and, for instance, the end of this century. And so even if government on the allocation issues wanted to clean up its act, I would suggest, as Harold has sort of alluded to, that the habitat issue associated with maintaining what integrity the subsistence economy has left may be even more important. But as I said, I didn't get into it originally because it hasn't really been relevant to discussing ANCSA.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Steve wanted to add something.
I wanted to ask Carol to just to follow up on the question of the importance of the mechanisms for the Hooper Bay Agreement with regard to the authorities vested in the AVCP and the Waterfowl Conservation Committee, the importance of jurisdiction being defined as tribal, and in the how was that seen or arrived at in this particular case?
I heard third hand that when California agreed to go along with federal proposed regulations, that the sovereign state of California said that yes, they would agree with this unless the governor of the sovereign state of California could make an agreement with the president of the sovereign nation of Association of Village Council Presidents to cut a better deal for California. So many of the sovereign people who are quite interested in sovereignty in our region thought that was a very very nice statement by the state of California. They the people have maintained that if they ever stop being Eskimos and Athabascan Indians, they're lost. They'll get trashed in any allocation decision. And the sovereignty issue, again, this is my perspective. The sovereignty issue has generated itself because of this threat to the way of life that the people want to maintain. And the Association of Village Council Presidents was very insistent that the relationship of the all the parties in this agreement had to be the villages, the individual village entity. It was they who, under peer pressure, would control the habits or change, modify the habits of the hunters there. Like Caleb was saying earlier, unless you go into the village and tell the guy, listen, this is the way the law reads, and this is what you're supposed to do. Most of the people, and again, I believe it was a political reason by AVCP to give the authority to the village entity, which is the tribal governing body of the villages. In some cases, there is no tribal governing body, and in that case, it was a traditional government that was given the authority to work on this agreement.
Peter Usher.
Well, just a reaction as a visitor to the three very interesting presentations that we heard right after lunch. I found myself agreeing with all of them, and so I wondered why that might be, since they all said quite different things. And it occurred to me that really they were talking about some quite different things. And therefore, I wonder, although this roundtable discussion is titled subsistence, I wonder if in fact there are perhaps three different issues that we might be addressing the future of. So perhaps I'll throw them out as possibilities and give you at least a very brief thought, my own brief thoughts on them, and then if some of them aren't valid, we can throw them out. But seems to me, first of all, we're looking at what is the future of subsistence. And that, it seems to me, is what Lawner and Holdhouse expressed. They, it seems to me, were somewhat pessimistic. I guess if I had to characterize Tom's view of what's happening with subsistence, it would be like one of your generals said about Hue in Vietnam, which was that in order to save subsistence, we had to destroy it. Sometimes I get rather pessimistic about the future of subsistence in the Canadian North as well. But then I think, well, you know, these are to some extent semantic terms. What we mean by subsistence and what other people might mean by subsistence, I think, are quite different. And in fact, that's been raised in some of the comments that people have made about the commercial use of subsistence resources. And it seems to me that the conventional non-native use of subsistence is nothing but a hindrance to the way native people would conceive of their resources and might like to use them in the future. There's a long history of the commercial use of so-called subsistence resources, certainly in Canada, and I'm sure in Alaska, that to all intents and purposes are traditional. And why we should be hung up on this notion of personal use and so on is quite beyond me. And I think that in our own society, somebody commented on the degree of subsistence life in the non-native economy. I think there's a lot more of it than most of us recognize. I live in an area in rural Ontario where there are a lot of old-time farmers around, and as I look at the definitions, the criteria for subsistence, which I find on page 26 of Steve's paper, I think, gee, an awful lot of my neighbors have subsistence rights based on those criteria, so what's the big deal? So I kind of think that if you want to look 100 years ahead, which is more the native time frame, I think, than our own Western time frame, but it's a good one to me. 100 years, what's subsistence going to look like? Well, it won't, in our conventional non-native terms, we might be quite pessimistic about it, but I suspect it's still going to be around, and that native people will have 100 years from now something which that generation very certainly defines as their subsistence use of resources. And it probably won't resemble what we think subsistence is right now. But there are two other issues, one of which is ownership or some kind of proprietary interest in resources. And when I look at the future of that, let's say 100 years down the road, and we ask ourselves, what is the possibility that Native people will, between now and then, gain some kind of title or recognized legal interest in their resources? And, you know, we could talk about that at some point as to what that might mean. I would say, that's entirely possible. It seems to me like a quite reasonable proposition. I think it's probably more likely in Canada than in Alaska because of your constitutional setup and so on, and the fact that it seems to be a non-starter to even refer to Aboriginal or Native people in legislation. But I think that's quite possible now when we talk about ownership of subsistence resources, then we're looking at a situation where maybe people are going to make their own judgments about what they want to do with those things. And they might want to use them for something quite different than subsistence, and that they will do in their wisdom or their lack of it. And we as non-natives can sit around and make comments about that, I suppose. But you know, the thing about property is it's not ours to dispose. You know, if it's somebody else's property, you can comment on how they dispose of it, but in the end, it's their right to do as they please with it, isn't it? And if we don't like it, that's too bad for us, but not necessarily for them. And I suppose the third issue is management. To what extent, when we look 100 years down the road, will Native people actually be managing their resources? And again, it seems to me the prospects for that are entirely possible. I mean, that's how would they manage their resources? Well, probably no better and no worse than the rest of us do with ours. So again, that's an incident of property, isn't it? If you own it, you can do with it as you please. But I see those things as quite separate issues. And if we're talking about the future of subsistence, and to some extent maybe forcing an idea of what subsistence is and lamenting the future of it, it's not the same as saying, will Native people in Alaska get to own and do as they see fit with their property? They're separate.
Could I? Yes, Don.
I just had an immediate response to that, and a strong one, actually. And I think that is a completely unhelpful way to look at the situation. I mean, it seems to me property, again, is nothing more than one of those intellectual figments of our imagination. I own lots of property, particularly, I don't own enough real property, but I own real property. To say that I have any control to unilaterally decide what I want to do with that property is just not a correct description. I've got to go plead with the political institution of the Anchorage Municipality and the Planning and Zoning Commission and everybody else on earth and the state legislature to get their okay with respect to how I use that property. Their okay, or the standards they use to decide how I can use my property, is based upon a political equation that theoretically I participate in, but it's because I'm part of a political community. And to say that at any time the Native community should have any expectation, even if they get their hands on property, that they'll have any authentic self-control outside of a political community is just, I don't think, very intellectually helpful.
We'll have to adjourn in just a few minutes, so Peter, you'll have to wait until tomorrow to respond. Caleb Pangawi and Jonathan Solomon and Joe Meeker all want to say something this afternoon before we adjourn, and since the hall must be vacated for bingo in a few minutes, we'll have to make it brief. Could I just say, since I won't get another chance, I'm sure, to say anything this afternoon, that it seems to me that in one way or another you've been talking about ANCSA. ANCSA gave land. Let's not get into the argument about giving, and it was already ours and so on, but gave land to Native people. Don Mitchell has pointed out that the land, the money that came with ANCSA, the corporate structures, gave them a certain amount of economic and political influence, and I think everyone acknowledges that. I hope tomorrow we can begin to look at what is being done in other jurisdictions in land claim settlements to move from the concept of fee simple land to access to resources, because that's what all of these people have been talking about, is access to resources, access to fish and game resources, and we will no doubt hear from the people from Canada about the recent agreements that have been reached there and the measures taken, not so much for purposes of acquiring fee simple ownership of land, but to have the right to use land for subsistence hunting and fishing purposes. And it seems to me we are moving in that direction. And certainly, if I may be allowed to return to where we began this morning, and you'll recall that I spoke at the outset, I said I've been to these villages, I've heard from 800 witnesses, largely Native persons, and they are concerned about subsistence, they are concerned not about fee simple ownership of land, but about access to fish and game resources and guaranteed access in perpetuity so that those villages can survive and those people can survive. So I take the liberty of mentioning that so that it will perhaps give us something to think about as we contemplate tomorrow's discussions. Caleb, and then Jonathan Solomon.
Thank you. I wanted to respond to some of the statements that were made by the three people that were on the panel earlier. One of my initial reactions was that these three individuals, the closest they've been to Brevik Mission is probably Nome, Alaska, and the longest they've been in any village is probably Two Sleeps. And that when they were in that village, they were not there to review subsistence taking, but rather probably some other meeting. And one thing that really bothered me was a statement by Gary Holthaus in that statement that subsistence would die because we didn't teach it to our children. I think that's one of the most outlandish statements I've heard. And that if it is, then we're the victims of your society, in that the school system and these things that have been imposed upon us are something that we did not impose upon ourselves. And that we are not in control of the school system, and that the state school board decides what's to be taught in the school system. And one of the things that I feel, one of the best acts that was passed by the Congress in relating to continuation of subsistence was the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, in that the act totally exempted the Native population from regulation, and that the only time they would be regulated was if the species became depleted. Most of the game managers don't agree with that. They feel that there must be some kind of a human control in order for the species to be healthy, I guess is the best way to put it. Truly, that there is some species that have bothered the commercial fishermen. The sea otters, the belugas, and the sea lions have become a nuisance to the commercial fishermen. But not those species that have been used by the northern Alaskan villages, the walrus, the polar bear, the seals, the belugas. they've been pretty healthy. In 1976, when the state took over management, there was an agreement that put a limit on how much could be harvested. And that human management of the taking of walrus, I think, was probably one of the worst management tools that were agreed by between the federal government and state government, in that they did not take into consideration the number of population of the walrus, but rather they just took estimated harvest levels of the village and said, this is what it's going to be. And they set quotas for the villages. And for those villages that they did not know about, they allowed a certain number of animals that could be caught, but they would not be counted in that quota. And what happened is that most of the villages would reach their quota, and then they would have to stop hunting while the walrus population passed by. By 1978, we formed the Walrus Commission, and I'll talk to that when I get to the panel later on concerning Walrus Commission. But our fear was that the population of the walrus had increased to such an extent that something needed to be done to it. Fortunately, Tokayak won in the case in which the state reluctantly agreed to not continue the management of walrus, and we could get back to our harvesting of walrus at the levels that we previously did. I think, you know, some of these things I feel point out to the, some of the problems with regulatory schemes that are developed to control human taking. The thing that Laurie said this morning about the system of accepting proposals by the game boards and acting on them, I think the game board is subject to politics. You must realize that. And it was just recently that we got involved in terms of making proposals and recommendations for change for management of these species, of various species. And if that proposal did not have blessing of the staff, most of the time it didn't pass the game board. And or if it didn't, was not presented to the advisory boards, it did not get past the game boards. Norton Sound Fish and Game Advisory Board was one of the first ones that was organized in the state of Alaska. But the people that were originally on there were handpicked. They were handpicked by the staff at the Fish and Game. And it took us 4 years to get some people on there whom we felt could adequately represent some of the needs of the people. Why did it take us so long? The advisory board was a self-appointing board in that they and only they could make nominations to appoint somebody to that board. And I think these are kind of things that we need to address. The thing that Gary Holzhaus said about that we are the solely responsible for the continuation of subsistence, it really, you know, again, it really bothered me. But also, it was a way out. You guys are to blame for the failure of subsistence, not us, because you didn't teach your children. But I think also in this particular round table and future discussions on subsistence that our hope, or at least my hope, is that we will not repeat atrocities that have happened in the past, and that we will work toward a more workable solution concerning subsistence and the resources on this land.
Thank you, Caleb. Jonathan Solomon.
Mr. Chairman, you know, when I walk in here this afternoon, getting off the plane from Fort Yukon to here, you know, I had great, I don't know how this meeting is going to be run, but all of a sudden I walk into the situation I've been in before, that all non-resident of rural Alaska discussing subsistence for rural Alaska. They're great authorities on these things, but they invite us, which is the greater authority than theirs, and they don't have give us a chance to get in the discussion with them. You know, my friend Jerry Holhouse talk about culture, and he talk about dancing, which he don't know a damn thing about. When you play shamanism, we teach our kids that we have to show these other non-natives and non-rural Alaskan residents a part of what we believe in. And we do that through the dances, through the potlatches, but these people never been to a damn potlatch. And he said he was, you know, he was down, whatever it was. because he's seen KISS dance at the AFN convention. Them dance are created for this environment here in Anchorage. The creation of Native dances and Native culture exists only in every Pearl village. When you see dances in Native villages, if you ever get the opportunity, you will never see these things. They don't go by what you see on the platform of a dance hall in Anchorage. Unless, I know damn well, sitting here, what Don Mitchell's going to say. I heard it 10 drilling times, but I do not know what my brother next door going to say. That's what I came here to listen to. And I see a great big piece of paper by my friend Tom. You know, and I know what he's going to say. I heard him a lot of times too. And Dave Cass, let's get this thing down and bring these rural people in like you're doing now and sit down and explain what, you know, find out exactly what we think. We're the traditional rural subsistence users. We came from the village. We lived there all our life. Do we have a problem with it? Don Mitchell himself, I don't know how long I know him. Don't know what my problem with subsistence is. He never asked. But he sure done a hell of a lot of paperwork on it, writing. Tom Lawner, same thing. Let's get down to it. Unless this is done, then I'm wasting my time here. Thank you.
Thank you. It's 4:30 sharp. Joe, we can stay a few minutes if you want to add something. Well, I think it's been a useful day. I want to thank you all, and I think that the troika of Mitchell, Lawner, and Holthaus have succeeded in infuriating a good many of the people here, and that may well have been their object. So we'll carry on tomorrow, and if you have any suggestions about the way in which we're proceeding, as I said, speak to Rosita Worrell or to David Case or to myself, because we would like to know. We wanted this to be a meeting of people with all points of view, and so far we're getting them, and I hope that will continue. So we'll start at 9 in the morning.
What do you say to Jonathan? Anything? Say anything to Jonathan Solomon?
I want to talk to him.
Oh, I think that's partly a routine. I mean, and it's legitimate. I mean, that's. Okay.